Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Phil Oakley. How are you doing, Phil?
Very good, thanks, John.
Nice holiday?
Yep, good, thank you.
Feeling refreshed?
No, I'm a bit tired this week.
Great. And once again, Michael Taylor. How are you, Michael?
I'm good, thanks, John. How are you?
Not too bad. You're still in town, which
good.
Is why we've got you on.
And,
you know, as if by sort of some sort of prescient magic, we talked about Burford last week. And
we did.
That is the story of the week.
It's,
so I'm glad you're still
in. Story of the week.
I'm glad
indeed.
You're still in town. We can talk about that. I mean, there's been absolutely loads of results this week. Phil, you've covered quite a lot of them in your Alpha report, including one that I know you're very keen to talk about that missed the magazine cutoff. But which released its results today, which is Hargreaves Lansdown.
Yeah,
maybe let's start with that before we come into the Burford meat of this podcast sandwich. Let's start with Hargreaves.
Well, it was more of the same from Hargreaves, really. Just incredibly profitable business. It doesn't seem to. It's probably a bit too early to see if it's been affected by what's gone on with the Woodford saga. And I'm not prepared to really go over ground there because I think it's been done to death. But again, this is just staggering financial performance from this business. Just, I think the word, you know, you could get to the situation where you could legitimately say it verges on the obscenely profitable based on what it does. And I just, you know, I could continue to be stunned by its business model and its charges and how there's so much inertia amongst the customer base that keeps those profits high. I think the thing for me that really stuck out to me today was the margin it's earning on its customers' cash balances. It's 72 basis points.
And that's up on where it
was. Yeah,
it was
48 basis points a year ago.
I mean, it's quite extraordinary given that everywhere else you have to pay to keep your money.
Well, yeah, we have a theme in the world now where you have to pay to save money. And gilt yields are 0.5 or 50 basis points, and Hargreaves Lansdown's making 72 basis points on customer cash balances, which is almost the same as it's making off its. It's managed funds.
I think that's quite interesting in the context of what you talk about in the introduction to your AF report. And in fact, what Michael, we talked about last week and your own cash position, that many people who do like to play the markets are actually quite heavily in cash at the moment. So not only are they making more money on their cash balances than they were a year ago, but probably more people are sitting on more cash. I mean, it's quite mad. I mean, what was it you said to me last week, Michael, about your...
Generally bearish. I'm not all cash, but cash is my largest position, and that's purely based on charts. So I'm not like Phil, who actually does the hard work.
No, I'm not all cash, no.
You told me you were all cash.
No, I'm not.
You've done something this week, haven't you?
I've got some skin in the game.
Okay, but you told me this week that you'd done something quite interesting around gold.
Yeah.
Tell us about it, Phil.
Well, I've been quite... I mean, we talked about the gold price, what, 3-4 weeks ago? And, you know, in a world of negative interest rates, the foregone alternative of holding gold, which all the bears of gold say don't own gold because it doesn't pay any interest, well, if I'm having to have negative interest on government bonds, then gold actually doesn't look too bad in comparison. And, you know, you see what's going on with the... central banks across the world cutting interest rates, printing money. This is a good background for gold. And you throw in geopolitical concerns about what's going on in the Gulf. You've got the US trade dispute. You've got quite a good background for gold. And, you know, my main reason to be mildly upbeat on gold is that it seems that the central banks across the world want to destroy money. And, you know, you can't destroy gold, really. I know, obviously, you can melt it. But
it's still there, though. It's still gold,
isn't
it?
Yeah, it's still there. And, you know, I think you know, I'm not a gold bug, but I think there's a lot of quite unfair comments made around gold bulls, because they see it as, you know, a barbarous relic, I think it's been called, hasn't it? And Warren Buffett's been very dismissive about gold. But well, it depends what time period you want to look at. I mean, gold has proven to be, quite good place for your money in different states of the world, different periods of time.
I think Warren Buffett's objections to gold came at a very different point in where we are in terms of the sort of market and economic cycles as well.
Yeah, but you look at
where you have negative interest rates, the arguments that he has put forward make little sense. And also in the context of what you can buy from an equity perspective, which you touch on in your report as well, which you've touched on in your column in the magazine.
Yeah, well, gold actually since 1971, since August 1971, is up over 40 times. That's more than the stock market before dividends are reinvested, admittedly. But no, I mean, I just bought a small position in a gold mining ETF to just leverage the gold bet. It's not going to make or break my portfolio, but I just thought I'd have a dabble.
You interested in gold, Michael?
Well, if you look at the charts, breaking multi-year highs, so
I think
the price is telling you that something's changing. Yeah, it's going to pull back short-term.
I think it'll pull back. It's gone very quickly upwards.
Well, we spoke maybe a month ago about it when it was...
Yeah, it's put on $100 in the last three, four weeks. Yeah. So you'd think there's some sort of pause for breath, but...
Mm.
The macro backdrop of, you seem to have a currency war going on. You've got an interest rate war going on. The German bond market now, which other, people are picking up on, is now negative right the way across the yield curve from short-term bonds to 30-year bonds. You've got $15 trillion worth of debt now, of traded debt on the markets with negative yields. And, the only reason to own that is if you believe it's going to go more negative, which it might do. But if you're looking for income, you are not going to get income. It's moved away from a meager income, apart from the US Treasury market. And I'm quite bullish on US Treasuries. And they've come back a lot. I think they could go all the way to zero for what it's worth.
Still get a bit of income off UK of gilts.
Gilts about 0.5, you're about what, 1.7 on US Treasuries.
Although we published the UK yield curve and in relation to sort of a 3-month and a 1-year history as well. And I mean, it's sagged.
Yeah.
I mean, it's drooped substantially recently.
But what I find fascinating about this is the different messages that are being given by the bond market and the equity market. And the bond market is saying bad things are ahead. There's bad things ahead in the road. And that's not consistent with equity markets and valuations of various types of shares that are very, very high.
Who are you going to trust though, Phil?
I have the highest regard for the bond market and people who work
first
in the bond market.
Yeah. They want to protect what they have, the little upside.
Yeah, I think some incredibly smart people who work in the bond market. I'm not saying there aren't in the equity market, but it just seems to me that they both can't be right. And I think you've still got this, there is no alternative story driving the stock market, in that you're getting no yield on cash, you're getting no yield on bonds. Let's go for where there is some yield and let's go into equities. But what you're forgetting, if you subscribe to that view, you've got to be mindful of the fact that these equity valuations are not just about yield, they have implications of growth. And if those growth forecasts don't come through, you're going to lose money.
And let's talk about that dichotomy, because you've talked to your Alpha report this week about if you want to buy into equities, you should be looking for quality.
Yeah, always.
Which is fair enough.
Yeah.
But even now, discerning what quality means is becoming more difficult. In your column, you talk about the fact that if you have a quality company but it's not delivering growth, then essentially it's a waste of time.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, you're buying whatever company you're looking at, whether it's the best business in the world or the worst business in the world, you are essentially, when you buy the shares in that company, you're buying a claim on the future cash flows that business will produce. Now, if I've got really low margin, battered up, tired old business that's growing a little bit, that's actually better than buying the best business in the world, perhaps, where the profits aren't growing and going down, because you're essentially, you can be buying, particularly in this market, you're being asked to pay very high price just because of quality. And I think this quality investing theme, something I'm a massive fan of, but I've been going on for a long time now thinking this is a very, very crowded trade. And I just don't think for a lot of the companies out there that the growth that these companies are delivering are not consistent with the high valuations that are being put on the shares.
So the example you've used in your column is Croda, which we talked about when we did our podcast from, Sunny Malden the other week. But it's a theme that seems to be coming through in a lot of the results we're looking at. So you've been about Spirax.
Yeah.
I don't know if Hargreaves...
Intercontinental Hotels.
Intercontinental Hotels.
You know, they've got, 2% profit growth. To be fair to them, they're more modestly rated, but... You know, Spirax profit growth was 3% and their shares that were trading on 31 times earnings.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Your trading radar goes up there. You
know, we mentioned Fevertree. You know, Fevertree profit growth was only 7% a few weeks ago on something that's on 40 times earnings. And, you know, I totally get the idea why you would want to own a slice of resilient businesses with strong franchises, but at the end of the day, it's the growth element. And yes, you can make money and you can trade this and you can make short-term money, particularly if you're buying into an earnings upgrade cycle. But if that earnings upgrade cycle isn't there, and this is a thing that did for Spirax this week, you know, not just the sluggish growth and the problems in one of their businesses, the rest of the business actually doing really well, but they came out and said, actually, the growth forecast for the steam business, that's going to come down a lot in the second half of the year, and therefore we think our profit forecasts aren't going to change, and the shares sell off.
I think it's quite interesting, and there's a line in your Alpha report which I thought was which summed this up really neatly. You said, all this adds up to expected profits being in line with, this is for Spirax, by the way.
Yeah.
All this adds up to expected profits being in line with current expectations, which is what you'd want to see.
Yeah.
But the stock market valuation needs upgrades. You know, when we see an RNS, we want things to be in line.
Hmm.
But investors are increasingly asking for more than that.
Yeah, and there's loads of examples of this. And let's take, you know, you probably know quite a bit about, Mike, is Boohoo.
Right? Boohoo, yeah. Right?
So this is something that traded on, a couple of years ago, traded on 100 times earnings because it had loads and loads of upgrades. And since then, apart from, obviously we've had a bit of corporate activity this week.
It seems to be turning into a bit of a Mike Ashley there. It's buy up a load of old junk that's gone bust.
Whatever. That's not a great strategy, I don't think. We'll see.
But the point I'm making is that since then, those shares have traded sideways or down, and they've traded in a range because there's been no upgrades. Mm. And because the valuation is so high, the potential buyer of that stock says, how am I going to make money buying a share at this high valuation when there's not an upgrade there?
Is it, Michael, is upgrade, you know, the upgrade cycle, the upgrade part, something you're looking
for
as a trader?
It does help. But with Boohoo, what I've noticed is the price is actually coming back to those highs. And if you look in 2017, when they had very good results, they actually sold off on big volume. And I pointed that out as a warning that things might be changing. And in 2 years, they haven't actually made a new high. But now they're getting to that new high. And I might actually buy them for a trade. I'm not entirely sure on the fundamentals. You'd have to talk about that, Phil. But
I've not looked at the deal.
For a trade, I think it looks quite good.
I think
if it breaks that high.
The Karen Millen story this week, I've not really looked at it. So I can't really comment. But obviously that is something that is piquing interest back into Boohoo.
I guess that's sometimes what you need is a bit of corporate news.
But it's about expectations. It's about the expectations that the market has for a company's profits. Now, if those expectations are being continually revised upwards, you get an upwards momentum trade.
To be fair to Boohoo, they do seem to have structured this deal in a slightly different way to perhaps some of Mike Ashley's recent deals. They're not interested in any of the bricks and mortar stuff. It's the pure online business.
But the thing about Boohoo, John, even though its shares have traded in a range, the company has still been churning out excellent results. But the trouble is what's factored into the share price. If it's not better than what people expect, and you've got a high valuation, the shares have got nowhere to go.
Yeah, no,
that's from a sort of fundamental trading perspective.
That could be why they're consolidating for the past two years.
I think we
might see further growth and people buy into that growth.
Could well do.
But the high street backdrop is horrible.
It's not good.
I know that, you know, retail is something you look at as a trader. We talked about it earlier.
We did.
A recent trade of yours.
I'm short MKS, Marks and Spencers. It's a small position, but if you look on the chart, those 2008-2009 lows are, I think, 183 pence. And I think if that goes, it's in trouble. And if you look, the valuation, I think it's about 3.6 billion. What is there? I mean, there's 4 billion of property on the balance sheet. I think 1.5 billion of debt. I'd have to check again.
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah. But what's in that equity? I mean, the stores, I go in there and it's terrible. I just don't think that it's a very good proposition. I think it's overvalued. Could it become another Debenhams? I'm not. It's very different because it's got huge amount of property, so Oxford Circus, things like that in prime positions. But if revenues keep going down and the high street keeps taking a battering, where could that be in a couple of years? I mean, we'll see. But for me, it's that key level. And if that goes, a lot of people are going to be watching that level and a lot of people are going to short it. So that's the level for me, 183. And I've got a starter position now, but I'm quite happy to average into that position and get short a bit more.
I do find it interesting that, I mean, and although you say you only care about the price and the
yeah,
chart, but you are talking about fundamentals here, which,
well, yeah, I use fundamentals for ideas because you can get a narrative, then you can find ideas, and if you can find something that backs up your ideas along with the price action, then it might be a good trade.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the price matters. Because it doesn't matter how good or bad a stock is. If it's going up and you're long, you've made money. I mean, that's pure and simple as a trader. That's what you want to do. And if something's really good, but it's going down and you're short, well, you made money.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what matters.
Talking to the high street, Phil, going back to our podcast, home bargains. I went to buy something that I didn't end up buying, but I bought something else, which was beer.
Yeah.
It's astonishing. What it does, it's very, as you say, very narrow, but the price is unbeatable. I think this has implications for trading, as I think, you know, high street trading, as you said when we spoke a few weeks back. It's crazy.
I think it's arguably the best brand discounter out there.
Mm-hmm. But B&M is like it too. So I just think it's an interesting model, and I think
it's as we said a couple of weeks ago. I think you're right. I think this is a story. This discounting, private label, value has got legs in it still.
I'll tell you something I've never found to be of especially decent value. That's a Domino's pizza.
I don't know a single person who's ever paid full price for Domino's pizza.
Yeah, it's still expensive, though.
Still,
even at 50% off, they're still expensive.
It is incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
And you've written about them this week, Phil, and I know this is a company you really don't like very much at all.
I used to like it. And it just shows you that, you know, you go investing is like a journey. You know, you look at a company, you get to know a company, and you learn about it as the company itself goes through its journey, its strategy, and its day to day existence. You learn more and more about it, and up to about two or three years ago, this was a fantastic story. But what's clear now, and I think what's really fascinating about this company is that one of the reasons why people used to love this stock is because it was a franchising business. Franchising businesses can be very lucrative for the franchisor. So you've got Domino's is a franchisor, McDonald's is a franchisor, Intercontinental Hotels are franchisors. So what happens is that all the costs or the large amount of the costs of running the physical business get lumped with the franchisee. They then pay back royalty payments, and in Domino's actually makes most of its money from selling pizza ingredients to its franchisees. But what's absolutely key about a business like this is that a franchising business, from the franchisor's point of view, can only be as healthy as its franchisees' businesses are. And what's happening with Domino's here is that we've got a real standoff between it and its franchisees. And its franchisees are very powerful. There are one or two very, very big franchisees that control about nearly 40% of all the UK outlets. And they're a bit grumpy about a couple of things, really. First one is things like ingredients prices, particularly the cheese price. That moves around. Domino's seems to be very quick to pass on any increase in price to the franchisees, but maybe not so much in terms of taking it back when it goes down.
Isn't that the same everywhere?
Same everywhere.
That would annoy me.
Big criticism of the electricity companies, of course, the energy companies. The other thing, though, and this is the thing that, you know, I've been bearish on Domino's because of it, is this strategy of growing by splitting its territories. Now, in layman's terms, splitting territories, the best way to describe it is that if you live in a town where there used to be two Domino's pizzas, there's now a third one. So
you're selling territories got a bit smaller.
Selling territories got a bit smaller. But this is an issue for the franchisees, because what happens, or what is happening, is that the third store takes sales from the first store and the second store. And potentially the third store doesn't make enough to get up to acceptable levels of profitability. So you can be a franchisee in an area and you open up a new store, you're put under pressure to open a new store, because the only way that Domino's can keep growing is had this ambition to get from sort of 1,150 stores to, say, 1,600 in the UK. The only way it can do this is by splitting its territory, and it's hurting the profits of the people that it's reliant on.
There is another way. And that's to expand outside of the home country, to go into
tried that, and it's not working.
It's not working at all, is it?
No, it's not working.
The Germans don't like overpriced, quite doughy pizza.
But the Germans have got Dörners, which are very good.
Yeah, because you spent some time at them.
I did, and they are fantastic. And I never once had Domino's in Germany because I didn't need to.
What are these things?
So they're like Dörners. A kebab,
right?
With a typical doner kebab, as you would say in English, with spiced lamb meat, all the vegetables, salad, garlic sauce, whatever sauce you want.
They're just not into pizza then.
Top tier food. Very cheap as well. And when you look at Domino's, what are you paying? £10 for a margarita pizza? I mean, that is just insane.
It is.
It's a lot. It's a lot to pay for.
I think affordability is an issue. I mean, you look at, you know, if you just look at some of the stuff that, you know, that the supermarkets are putting out now in terms of their sort of ready meals, take-home meals, pizzas, they're getting pretty sophisticated.
Well, I noticed in Morrison's, they're kind of bundling stuff, so it's as though it's a takeaway.
Yeah.
I know they've been trying that for years, and I know the product quality's not always been there, but...
But I agree. You know, you want to order a takeaway pizza from not just Domino's, but Papa John's and your Pizza Huts of this world, and it's, you know, quite a serious outlay of cash. But my sort of question now on Domino's is whether this UK franchising business is actually broken now, and whether it can be fixed, and whether it can be fixed in a way that allows Domino's to grow its sales and its profits without really hurting the profits of the franchisees. And we've now got pretty much a boycotting of new store openings. And this looks to be a really difficult position. The chief executive is retiring, but a new chief executive is going to have to try and sort this out. And Domino's has got nearly 50% of this market. How is it actually physically going to get much bigger without cannibalising? And we've seen cannibalisation, you know, great example of cannibalisation was Restaurant Group a few years ago.
Cannibalising itself, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was opening up its two different brands next door to each other.
They still do that.
You know the Army and Navy roundabout?
I do, yeah.
And they had a Chiquitos next to a Frankie's and Benny's.
Yeah.
And the Chiquitos went, and now the Frankie's and Benny's.
Frankie and Benny's is terrible.
There's a general oversupply in the industry anyway. There's too many restaurants chasing too few shoppers, too few diners. And I just wonder whether Domino's now, this standoff, it's got to the limits of where it can expand to now.
I mean, the market doesn't seem very sure Michael, have a look at that chart. I mean, it's not sure, is it? It's not really sure where this is going. It's
coming up to a new low, in which case I'd be interested in a short.
But it's been bouncing around for a while.
It has been. But as I said last week, that level where the shares are bouncing off is significant. And if it takes out that low, then the price is telling you that something's changed.
Mm.
And you get trend followers jumping on that, shorters jumping on that. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. When the share's going down, people think it's going down, so they sell and shorters jump on board.
I think some people have always clung to the hope that someone might come and buy it. So Domino's Pizza's Enterprises, owner of the Australian master franchise for Domino's, has been touted in the past as a possible buyer. But whether you'd want to take this on with, you know, you've got a loss-making European business, you've got a UK business, which is, yes, it's still growing a little bit, but it's got a lot of problems with, you know, underneath the bonnet, shall we say. Whether you want to take that on and pay a big premium for it, I'm not so sure.
We have seen lots of bids recently, but maybe don't put all your eggs in this basket. Let's talk about the big story of the week. I know you've all been waiting with bated breath for this. Obviously, Burford is the big story of the week. It's one where you know, the price has sort of led a lot of the action over the last couple of days. And I know, unfortunately for you, Michael, you want to try and go with Desert London.
Yeah.
You missed most of it.
I never say. It's not the worst place to be. So.
Which is great, because we can talk about it. So, Burford, which is a litigation financing company that this week found itself on the receiving end of what you would call a short attack. Bear Raid. I mean, there's subtle differences between these things.
Yeah.
A company called Muddy Waters, which, if you've seen a documentary on Netflix called The China Hustle.
It's a very good documentary.
Which actually is really, really
it's good. Very good. I'd recommend everyone to watch that, by the way.
I think everyone should watch that.
Yeah, they should. Because this stuff goes on even on the London market, and people don't realise.
Well, actually, you know, what I will say before we move on to the Burford story is having, I'd seen these guys at work over the years. Quindell was the kind of first one I think I really paid attention to, which was an attack by an outfit called Gotham Capital, Gotham City, I can't remember exactly what, Gotham, the whole Batman thing. But they were kind of right in the end. But the whole thing was, it was a very strange experience to be watching this. But Muddy Waters, when I saw them on this China Hustle documentary, they seemed like serious guys.
I
think they are serious guys. So they put out a tweet at 1:30 on Monday saying, what are they called? They said, we're going to have a blackout now until 8 o'clock.
Yeah, it was very dramatic, wasn't it, John?
8 o'clock.
A news blackout.
News blackout.
Like that. Yeah.
8 o'clock, London time. And yeah. I guess everyone said, wow. London time?
Oh, wow.
London?
Got to be a London company.
It's got to be a London company. Yeah. So speculation started to mount. And then about 30 minutes later, you started to see the share price of Burford moving down. I think a couple of others were going as well, but this one really gathered some momentum. And 8 o'clock the next morning, nothing came. I think the share price bounced a little bit at 10 o'clock
in
the morning.
Yeah, you would have had to have some minerals for that. But, you know, there was fair play to those who traded that. There was a good little scalp there.
But it was Burford. And they put out a very
lengthy. When it came out, it really did dump straight away into auction, down big style.
And I think it got down to about sort of 65% down on the day. It already been down. It was already down 20% the day before when it was just rumour.
Yeah.
So this was kind of crazy. And, you know, we know this is a popular stock with retail investors who've made a lot of money out of it over the years. Anyway, the next development was, obviously, Burford had, they put out a statement even before the Muddy Waters report had come out. They put out another statement when it did come out saying they were going to refute it. And then today they've actually put something out saying, here is our defence document, and the shares when we last looked, they're up about 40% today. So this has been a roller coaster.
It has.
But I mean, from our perspective on the Investors Chronicle, it's kind of like, we can't react quickly enough to really do much about this. Traders, you can. And we talked about putting a short on.
We did.
Last week.
I did. I did try.
You had your eye on it.
I did hear from other people that some of the less well known brokers did have Burford Capital short.
Well, you struggled, didn't you, to get...
I tried IG and SpreadX, couldn't get anything.
And that was even before the Muddy Waters rumour came out.
Yeah, and I think the stock dropped quite a bit before. And that was a trade that I was talking about. But if you'd have ran your winners, you would have struck gold, because this thing did come out And it was Burford, and it's just absolutely dumped. And those are the trades that you sort of dream of, that, you know, you might be long something and all of a sudden a takeover comes or things like this. But it's not nice for private investors, because this thing has just completely obliterated them. And I think
they're kind of back a long way from where they were sort of, you know, close by yesterday. You know, it's come back. And
it has,
I guess,
come
that
back.
There is a sort of, I don't want anyone to lose money.
No, of course not.
Of course I don't.
It's not nice.
But equally, this is a fascinating story. This is a fascinating story that it kind of holds a mirror to many things going on in the market. Behaviour's good and bad. You know, both on the side of perhaps those interested in short selling, those you know, buying shares that they think are going to rise a lot just because they're going to because they think they're going to rise a lot. And there are loads of things going here that I think we need to talk about. Phil, I know you're not a big fan of companies like this, as I alluded to in my editorial this week, mainly because they're really hard to understand.
Yeah, this is a difficult one. It seems that there's so much going on. So many ways of presenting your profit in terms of estimates, judgments, timing, and just generally very, very complicated sets of numbers. You know, they look, you know, one of the reasons I can't invest or wouldn't invest in banks is because, you know, I look at the numbers and I don't really understand what's going on. And you know, you look at something like this, I just can't do it.
You said to me earlier, I want to see the cash moving through the business.
Yeah. So when I look at any business, you want to see how everything links together. So you want to see how things move from revenues, profits, cash flows to the balance sheet. And this, I mean, I'm not saying you can't do it with this, but it's quite hard.
Takes too much work.
There's a lot of work needed. And you know, the first thing you look at a company like this, and I mentioned this on Twitter, you know, yesterday. I'm a great believer in trying to keep things as simple as possible. So when you look at businesses, your first place to really go to is look at the cash flow statement, look at the cash coming in, look at the cash going out of the business.
And I think I read yesterday this company hasn't actually had an operationally positive cash flow for
2013.
About 5 or 6 years.
I think there was a little bit of trading cash inflow in the half year results.
Okay. But nowhere near the level of profits that it's reported.
No, but you have to be careful with this, because you know, companies can present their trading cash flow in many different ways. And Burford presents its cash flow after the funding. So it funds these new cases. The outflow of money related to the funding is netted off before you get to the operating cash flow. But this in itself is something that should set off an alarm or a sort of get your eyes up. When you see a business that doesn't generate either trading cash flow or net or free cash flow, you've got to ask yourself why. Generally, if you have a lot of confidence, to have confidence in the numbers of a company, you want to see the profits turn into cash flow. Mm. Or you want to see a way of where you can sort of see a kind of an adjustment and you think, okay, yeah, there's real cash there. Because whilst there's a huge investor preference for companies that generate lots of free cash flow, it's not necessarily a bad thing if a company has negative or cash outflows, as long as that cash flow is invested and it's going to come back later on with a big whopping return on the money you spent.
Which I guess was also the reason why Burford was able to sort of carry that story, because the idea was that it's going to invest in these cases and the returns would be huge. And that, you know, one of the points of the Muddy Waters report is that it's been overstating what those returns might be. Now, obviously, Burford has rebutted that, but you know, Muddy Waters were not the first people to say this. And, you know, this is what I find quite interesting too. So Canaccord, broker Canaccord, put something out saying pretty similar things back in April. The share price reaction was nowhere near the same. Muddy Waters has caused an absolute, you know, storm here. Is it because of the way, and this is, I say this asking you as a trader, Mike, have they somehow magnified this effect in the way they've gone about it?
Well, they've got a good reputation, and you've got to look at 2016. They accused St Jude's Medical of their implantable medical devices and pacemakers of being hackable. Now, of course, the company refuted this, took them to court. The US Food and Drug Administration were on the side of Muddy Waters. So they've done their research, and that, to me, tells me that they're probably right. So they've got that reputational backing where people think, okay, I know how this has gone in the past. It's probably going to be the same way.
So it'll be a heavier hitter.
Yeah. I mean, I could have done all that research and posted it and no one would have cared. Everyone would have said, oh, you're wrong.
What do you feel about the, you know, the idea that they can say, you know, half us one the day before, we're going to put something out? And the speculation,
it's dramatic,
starts
isn't it?
The drama almost creates the more of an impact when it hits the next day.
Well, their goal is to make a profit. So the more drama that they have around it, the better it seems to them. And if you look at the original tweet, they didn't actually say Burford. That was Twitter people and bulletin board speculators saying it was Burford. And then the next day, Burford put an RNS saying, we believe such actions not right. Or I can't remember the exact phrase, but they were basically attacking something where nobody had actually said anything. So that, to me, was a big red flag. And as it turned out, it was Burford, and the share price tanked. But I would bet that Muddy Waters are on the money here.
Interesting. I wouldn't bet either.
I think the issue with the thing that intrigues me about this. Now, I've no idea. I've not looked at this in depth to know whether there's good or bad things going on here. But what I do know is that when you have a business that generates doesn't bring in cash flow, eventually you have to get the financing somewhere.
Well, they have raised a lot of money, and they're talking about raising more money now, so
it'll be hard for them now.
You know, businesses that keep going back for money time and time and time again, sooner or later the person that's giving you the money is going to say, look, when am I going to get this back? You know, there's this jam tomorrow type story. And you know, that will be a real test of the company in the next few weeks and months.
Having said that, people have not worried about piling back in today. I mean, you know, the company's obviously refuted the allegations with some quite fruity language themselves. It has to be said.
But eventually, as an investor in any company, you have to eventually see the cash. And I'm not saying that Burford won't see the cash. But, you know, you're being asked to wait a long time for this, you know, to keep investing and investing and investing and investing and deferring that day when the cash comes back. You know, you're asking investors to put more and more faith in your ability. And I can understand why someone just looks at this and starts questioning it.
We had an interesting response to our discussion on this podcast last week, Michael, from someone on Twitter who said, "Oh, having listened to your podcast this last week, I put a stop in on my birthday."
Oh yeah, we did,
and
yeah,
we saved some money.
Yeah, well, good for him.
So actually, you know, perhaps there is. I mean, I find it kind of weird that people buy into companies that they don't understand. But there you go.
Yeah, that's life.
But even if you do that, then there are ways to protect yourself potentially. I think, you know, if you're running a momentum stock, having that little bit of downside protection sort of trailing you up. As far as that's not a bad idea.
I don't think it is. And if you look at the share price, you could have actually known this at about £2. Then the share price goes to 20. You've made money. But we spoke about this last week, John. You could clearly see there were warning signs, because on the results, it spiked up and it came right back down on big volume. And I pointed that out as an indicator. I mean, it's a caution flag, because so far, the trend had been up for years and years, and past 6, 7, 8 months, it's gone sideways. And there's a reason for that. And you might not know what the reason is, but eventually you find out, because the chart tells you. And it's the case with so many profit warnings. Stocks will start drifting down before they announced the profit warning, or even with placings. What happens with placings is people short them. So I'll get made inside on a stock and I'll see the share price dump the same day, presumably, because insiders are selling. And these things show up in the charts. So I think if an investor, I get, Phil, that you should be looking at the cash flows of the business because that's what you're investing in. But you should really be looking at the charts because the charts tell you what the market is thinking or what the market is doing, and that can protect you.
Sounds to me like you should have a sort of an arsenal of different approaches.
Yeah, of course.
There's definitely information in the chart. It's just a question of whether that information is already baked in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I suspect the story has some way to run. We'll be talking about this in the weeks ahead, and maybe you'll be trading it. But
maybe I will. We'll see.
I think the price is up to about £9 by the time we came in here.
But, it's done pretty well if you were buying a four.
Yeah.
£4 yesterday.
Absolutely. I have to say, the one thing that came out of the Muddy Waters report, accounting aside, there's some serious corporate governance reflected in this company I really don't like at all.
But what's interesting is I'd never seen any of these corporate governance flags raised until yesterday, and yet it is an efficient market. Muddy Waters didn't have any inside information. They've pulled this. Anyone could have done it, but nobody did.
Yeah, I don't get it either.
It's a great example of how stuff that's out there, particularly annual reports, just don't get read. People don't read them.
Stuff things at the bottom.
Professional investors, it's amazing. This is why I'm such a big fan of annual reports, because I know that lots of people, the vast majority of investors, don't read them, and they're packed full of useful information.
One of the red flags that Muddy Waters highlighted was that they don't disclose or differentiate their executive remuneration in their wage bill.
I thought that was ruled, to be honest.
I thought it was as well. Apparently not. And apparently it's to do with the fact they're Guernsey listed. That's a horrible red flag for me.
Oh, you already know enough, don't you?
Yeah, there you go. And I won't even mention the fact that the chief financial officer is also the wife of the chief executive. Hey, you know, keep it in the family and all that.
But all this work could have been done.
Yeah.
So there is opportunity out there to make money. Long or short.
Muddy Waters did it.
And they did. And they've made a lot of money.
They have. Well, on paper.
I would imagine they've probably been closing some. I mean, why would you not?
Which could also explain the price.
Yeah. Covering it as well. Yeah, of course.
Despite whatever the conclusions are of this and whether they're right or wrong, there's no doubt here that there's been a group of people here have done a huge amount of intensive research. And I think hats off for that.
Yeah, I agree. Like I said, you know, having seen them speak through the China Hustle documentary, and also they put out some videos yesterday. I mean, they're not spivs.
No.
You know, they're serious
proper,
people.
Some proper shovel work being done here, and you know, there's arguably as Michael's just touched on, not enough of this gets done, and that's where your opportunities exist.
That is a big question about why people who had invested lots of money in this company weren't doing that shovel work, as you said. But that I suspect is a discussion for another time.
I think
because we've run out of time. Let me just talk you through what else we've got in the magazine this week. Actually, we have a Gordon Gekko on the cover. This happened before we even knew about the kind of spivvery going on in the markets this week. It's actually to illustrate our feature on ESG investing. Algie's actually, we've written about this before, but Algie's taken it on and started looking individually at companies and how they stack up on ESG measures, and why this actually might be a very good way for fundamental investors to be looking at companies. You know, what's good for the world is actually quite good for companies and their profits too. And this might actually start flowing through to returns, and he's got lots of evidence to suggest that might be the case. It's been a horrific week on the results front, really. We've barely touched on any of them. I say horrific, lots of very interesting, but horrific when you're trying to read all these pages and get this magazine out in double quick time. Lots of the personal finance and funds section, which they will talk about this week. John Barron has updated his investment trust portfolio, and lots in the news section as well, including our Burford write up. But there's been a couple of other horrible profit warnings this week. Serious Minerals was the other biggie. And yeah, another detailed look at what is happening with the sort of broad money markets and the possibilities of a UK rate cut on the way in the new spotlight. Anyway, thank you all for listening. Thank you, Michael, for coming in again.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, Phil. Good to have you back from your holes. Pick up the magazine and all good news agents. Green is good. Why what's good for investors no longer needs to be bad for society. And we will be back again next week. Thank you.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.